clearly the sign for Bank Holiday Weekend is to make sure that you are on trend when it comes to barbecue recipes. And who better to actually talk about the best and most contemporary barbecue recipes than indeed ace BBC chef extraordinaire. It's the fabulous Genevieve Taylor. How are you, Genevieve?
Hello. Yeah, I'm all good, thanks.
Excellent. So we were talking earlier in the week with Dr. Hilary Jones about how it's important to obviously make sure that you clean your furniture, you clean everything else, etc. You don't get any bugs from that point of view. I did suggest going to a barbecue in a hazmat outfit was not necessarily the way forward. But this thing, which ties in obviously with your new book, Charred, is a really exciting thing because it's a vegetarian barbecue recipe book.
It is a vegetarian barbecue recipe book. I think, you know, the people want to eat less meat these days, and the research from Napoleon Grills recently, you know, the survey shows that up to half of us want to try vegetarian and vegan barbecue options. So,
well, it's good for us, it's good for animals, it's good for the planet. Yeah. Why not, indeed, from that point of view? I was astounded to find that between April and September, the average British soul has 30 barbecues. That's quite a lot of barbies.
Yeah, that's a whole lot of meals, isn't it? Where you could be cooking all sorts of exciting things and not just burning another banger.
So, indeed so, whether it be vegetarian or otherwise from that point of view. So what inspired yourself, Genevieve, to actually come up with this this new vegan and veggie diet barbecue form?
Yeah, well, I'm not a vegetarian by any means. I describe myself as a sort of omnivore, committed omnivore, and I think, you know, I like to eat a little bit of really good quality meat and a lot of vegetables, lots of different colours and textures and flavours, and you can't get, you know, meat's sort of quite a one-dimensional texture, isn't it? But with vegetables, there's lots of different things you can do, lots of kind of crunch and colour and, you know, rainbow colours.
Now, we love our pets, or hopefully we love our pets, etc. But it's fair to say that with 75% of people giving their barbecue remains to our pets, it's not necessarily the best use of food. I mean, I suppose it's better than going to waste, but at the same time, there's other stuff we can actually use with those leftovers.
Yeah, of course. I mean, my pets get their fair share of leftovers, it has to be honest. But I think, specifically, if you're grilling kind of lovely vegetables and stuff, they are easier to do leftover dishes with. You know, you can turn grilled peppers and stuff into a lovely salad or put it in couscous or lots of different things that you could do with it that you couldn't do with kind of, you know, leftover cold sausages or whatever.
So in terms of, say, folk listening to this and thinking, well, vegetarian barbecue, you know, why have we waited so long with respect to that? Do you think there's still a reluctance that people actually think, yeah, if it hasn't got the sort of, as you said, fried sausage or whatever, et cetera, it's just not the same, really?
I think, you know, barbecuing is perhaps the last bastion of where you just chuck all the meat on the thing. You know, you wouldn't do that with any other meal, you know, even a beautiful kind of British Sunday roast, it always has a lot of vegetable sides to go with it, and I think barbecue is a bit behind in that, but you know, the research shows that people really want to kind of mix it up a bit and not just chuck all the meat on and have lots of different other stuff going on, and I think that's really exciting, and that's kind of why I wrote this book, to kind of give people more ideas for what you can put on a barbecue if you don't want to eat so much meat.
Now, in terms of numbers, Genevieve, I can honestly say you probably be able to cope with anything from like 4 to 40,000, basically, because you sort of you're on the case, etc. But what would you say is the ideal number for people to actually attend a barbecue?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, I barbecue all year round because I really love doing it. But I think you know, barbecue with your family and make it a relaxed thing, and don't try and be too ambitious with your barbecuing. Don't think you need to provide kind of 20 different dishes. You know, just think about it as a meal, as you would a meal inside, that you've got kind of, you know, a main course bit and then two or three different lovely sides, and try and get a small quantity of dishes done beautifully rather than thinking you have to do endless different dishes.
Are we getting more adventurous in terms of the kind of vegetables we're using? I mean, in terms of what you get?
Absolutely. I mean, I certainly think we are. You know, even in you know, supermarkets, you can get all sorts of really interesting vegetables these days. And during the course of writing my book and sort of working with Napoleon, I'm surprised by some of the vegetables you can barbecue. You know, smoked parsnips are one of my very favourite things from the book, and who knew you could smoke a parsnip, and you don't know till you try. So, you know, lots of different vegetables cook beautifully on a barbecue.
Yeah, it's worth noting that Napoleon grills actually involved, as opposed to a former French general who actually sort of looked to take over Europe, because you don't know.
No, exactly.
I mean, otherwise you would have entitled it "Not Tonight, Genevieve," as opposed to "Chard." You know, it's just a line that's whatever. The book, of course, is entitled "Chard." Not like I could ever imagine you charring anything, actually, from that point of view. But it is out next week, presumably for all good retailers and online, etc.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you go to Napoleon.com, there's lots of lovely video recipes we've created to give people inspiration.
Could also have been tied in with Napoleon Solo from The Man from U.N.C.L.E., but you're too young to remember that, Genevieve.
I think I am.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a different line entirely. Two final questions for your good self. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us this morning?
Yes, it's been very lovely.
Excellent. And can we prevail upon you to join us again in the not-too-distant future, Genevieve Taylor?
I would be delighted.
Hurrah!
Believe your eyes, if 10 million fireflies lit up the world as I fell asleep. 'Cause they fill the open air and leave teardrops everywhere. You'd think me rude, but I would just stand and stare. I'd like to make myself believe that planet Earth turns slow. It's hard to say that I'd rather stay awake when I'm asleep, 'cause everything is never as it seems. 'Cause I get 1,000 hugs from 10,000 lightning bugs as they try to teach me how to dance. A foxtrot above my head, a sock hop beneath my bed, a disco ball is just hanging by a thread.
Just right, I didn't leave you 'cause I was all through. Oh, I was overwhelmed. In fact, a downward spiral. My love for you went viral, and I loved you every mile you drove away. But now here you are again, so let's skip to how you've been and get down to the more than friends at last. Oh, but that one night is still the highlight. I didn't need you until I came to, and I was overwhelmed and frankly scared as hell, because I really fell for you.
Mixed mode transport in a musical sense, train and drive-by. Hey-ho. Time now to actually welcome back to the programme somebody who is always full of wonderful, incisive comments in kind of, in terms of dealing with the 21st century and so on. He's an ace actor, a general all-round super individual who is fully charged, and indeed hosts the YouTube channel Fully Charged. Scrap Heap Challenge, frankly, was actually in an ideal place when he was hosting the whole thing. Let's not even talk about Red Dwarf. It's the awesome Robert Llewellyn. How are you, sir?
That's got to be the if only that introduction could happen every morning in my kitchen, I would have a wonderful life. Thank
well,
you very much.
Feel free to download the podcast, although you can use it for that as you feel. Robert, good to speak to you as ever. But this particular aspect that we're talking about today, we've talked a great deal about climate change, the extinction agenda. This is something which clearly has permeated and percolated through our consciousness and will continue to do so. But you're actually coming up with some really great ideas in terms of why, on a weekend where we're looking at 13 million and more car journeys over the bank holiday weekend, maybe we should actually be going electric.
Well, I think it's going to happen anyway, but I mean, it's certainly something I would encourage people to adopt sooner rather than later. I mean, it makes a big difference in many different ways. And I think, you know, I completely sympathize with and understand people's anxieties who've never been in an electric car, or maybe have heard stories about, you know, throwing batteries in landfill, or that the grid will melt if we all have electric cars. That won't happen. Neither of those things will happen. But, you know, the change in attitude, I think, that it encourages is also very important. And it's, you know, part of a much bigger transition that we need to go through, that, it's become the norm for us to drive, you know, drive in combustion cars, petrol and diesel, and go to the filling station, fill them up, and, you know, moan about the cost, and then drive them, and then, you know, what's become much more common public knowledge is that the gases that come out of the tailpipe are actually toxic to human beings and life in general, and it might be worth considering changing that, you know. And that's it's going to be a long, slow process, but I think it is gaining momentum all the time, and that's certainly what our show reflects and what we're seeing, you know, just from the number of people who are interested in it. It's growing at a very rapid rate.
Last week, of course, we had the Midweek Drive team down in London for the Sci-Fi London Film Festival, and we parked outside London, we got the underground in there, and I must admit, I thought things had changed, but central London around the Prince Charles, and indeed the Spotlight casting director, I thought, my word, it's as bad as ever here. So
yeah. Yeah,
clearly there's a long haul to get through that process, as you rightly said. But then again, you know, people used to think, let's go diesel, that's nice and clean.
Yeah.
Didn't work at all, really.
No. I mean, that was an incredible
faux pas. I think is the best way, really,
from our government. Yeah, and I mean, it was very specifically this country. No other country really adopted small diesel cars to the extent that we did, and the damage they have done has been colossal. So I absolutely accept people's scepticism about that. You know, I was told to buy a diesel, and I did. And now you're telling me to buy an electric car. I'm not telling people to buy an electric car. I'm suggesting they try them.
Yeah.
And see what they're like. And I mean, all the reservations are completely justified, but the cost of buying a new electric car is only going to come down, and it is coming down already, and it will continue to get cheaper. Most of the predictions are by 2022 it'll be cost parity. So you go into a showroom, there's a petrol car, there's a diesel car, there's an electric one, they'll all cost roughly the same for the same type of vehicle. And that's when things will really change, because the infrastructure to support them is also expanding at a really surprising rate at the moment.
Robert, in the studio we've got, I would refer to as the next generation of broadcasters, etc., currently reading journalism, broadcast journalism at Leeds Trinity University. Emily, Emily, you've been having a look at this, you're a driver. Any questions for Robert?
Just why do you think people are hesitant to try driving electric vehicles?
There's probably multiple reasons. I mean, there's some... I'm going to be slightly sexist in an anti-sexist way. There's some blokes who will never change, and I said that's fine, you know, because they to make them feel good, they need to hear the roar of a beautiful piston engine. And I work with people like that, and they're lovely, and it's wonderful, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I think the majority of people who are not that interested in cars, which I would say is the majority of the population, once they've actually experienced it, it's absolutely universally accepted. It's kind of, I think it's slightly annoying term, but it's called the EV grin. They get out of it and they're grinning and they're going, wow, that's much better than I expected. So the experience of driving one is, I think, the key to it. A lot of people who haven't ever driven one will come up with the absolutely excuses that have been touted around for years. You know, they don't have the range, they're slow, they don't make any noise and you'll run people over. All those things are, you know, there's nowhere to charge them, all that sort of stuff. Mm. That's changed, and it's often when you hear a report about electric vehicles, it is accurate about electric vehicles from about 2010, 2011. The picture has really changed dramatically since then, and the cars have got better, they're more efficient, they go further, they're cheaper to run, the charging infrastructure is expanding all the time. You know, it's going to take some years before most of us are driving electric cars, but certainly within the next 10 years, it will become absolutely normal to drive an electric car. No one will comment on it, it's just a car.
It's interesting you mentioned some of the areas and excuses there, because I've been speaking to somebody who, to get to the studio this morning, actually, I drove up from Lincoln. It was a two-hour drive, 126 miles and so on. It's fine, etc. I have my trusty Volkswagen, petrol, of course, from that point of view, and that sort of fear about what if the charger runs out is something that certainly for slightly longer hauls is something which maybe is easy. But should I consider something like a hybrid and actually take a step-by-step route?
I mean, it's a difficult one. I think 5 years ago, but getting a hybrid was a really good, legitimate sort of stepping stone. And a lot of people who bought the early hybrids then went on to full electric. Now, I think there's really no excuse. There's no reason to buy a hybrid. I think it's essentially still a petrol car, so they might use slightly less petrol, but what you're doing with a hybrid is you're dragging around a petrol tank and a battery and an electric motor, as well as I think the days of the hybrid are numbered. That's going to annoy some people in certain companies that I know well, but I really do think so. And also the simple fact is, and these are AA figures, it's about 4,500 people a week run out of petrol or diesel on our roads. Now, no one talks about range anxiety with petrol or diesel, but people clearly have it, and they'll try and eke out the last fumes to get the maximum range they can out of their cars, and they don't want to buy petrol because it's expensive. People don't run out of electric. You know, the recovery services, a lot of them now have a battery inside the recovery van, so they can give an electric car a quick charge to get them to the nearest charger. They don't use them because the information you're given in an electric car is so comprehensive, you've got to deliberately, consciously scream and shout and not look at your control systems in the car to make yourself run out. You've got to run out on purpose because the car is screaming and beeping and flashing and everything at you for the 20 miles before you get anywhere near running out. So you can't run out like you can in a diesel car and it says empty and you think, oh, I can get another 10 miles out of it, then it runs out, which clearly happens all the time. So I'd only get range anxiety in a combustion car now.
Interesting. So what about driverless cars? Could that be the future? Will we expect all driverless cars to be electric and actually that be the case in point?
I think what we'll see way before that is driverless delivery trucks, driverless buses. I think those things are going to come much, much sooner. The vehicles that do a set route on a set journey every day, that is much more likely to happen. I think, you know, in the next 20 years, there will be a lot of cities that around the world that have fully autonomous vehicles driving around in certain sections of them. I think there are enormous complications regarding insurance, regarding safety, regarding how those technologies are implemented. I've been in autonomous cars. They're really impressive. They do drive better than human beings. But if they're driving on roads where human beings are driving, they've got an extra level of challenge to cope with. They're very energy intensive. The computing process uses a lot of power in terms of electricity. So you're reducing the range of the vehicle by having that. That said, all that stuff will improve in the next few years, and they're certainly getting better and better. I'm not completely convinced that we're going to see thousands of fully autonomous cars on the roads, you know, in the next 5-10 years. All over the place, because it's a really difficult challenge to overcome, and there's an enormous amount of money being put into developing them, but I'm not I might be wrong. I hope I'm wrong in some ways, because there is a, you know, clear advantage in having that. It means we don't have to own cars, and I think that's the way the next generation will go. The idea of private car ownership will fade, I think.
Let's test that then with Emily. Emily, you're part of that next generation. You have your own car. It's petrol, presumably.
Yeah, it's petrol.
So you'll be listening to this. I mean, will you? Has this convinced you to say, I'm going to go electric, I'm going to go rental, whatever?
I'd be up for trying an electric one, seeing how it drives, but I don't know.
That's a possibility, Robert. Yeah. So there we are. You know, the next year we're doing our little bits to hopefully just get that nudge there.
I mean, getting a test drive. Well, I mean, obviously, if you can come to Fully Charged Live, our show, there's about 3,000 test drives available there. But you know, a car dealership will give you, often give you a test drive. There's a wonderful company in Milton Keynes, the Electric Vehicle Experience Centre, and you can rent an electric car there for incredibly cheap rates, much cheaper than would normally be commercially available. Whole range of electric cars, but yeah, certainly that's why we're putting this show on, is to show people what the cars are really like, what they can really do. It's proving to be a very popular show.
Robert, we talked about the YouTube channel Fully Charged. Share with us how people can find out even further information about Fully Charged Live 2019 and where they should go and so on and so forth.
Very good, yes. Well, if you come to Silverstone on the 7th, 8th or 9th, or even all three if you're really crazy, 7th, 8th and 9th of June, we're having this very big show. It's a good family day out, loads of amazing food, loads of drink, live music, as well as thousands of electric vehicles from all types, you know, really wide range, but also, and I think equally importantly, an enormous amount of stuff about stuff you can put in your home. So solar panels, home battery storage, heat pumps, amazing water heaters that cost a fraction of what we do when we use burning gas to heat water, all those things. So heating systems, energy control systems for your home, lots of experts giving millions and, not millions, that would be an exaggeration, hundreds of talks over the weekend. There's two big theatres where we have lots of discussion panels and presentations, which were amazingly popular last year. And it will be rounded off on Saturday night by a very good friend of mine, Mr. Craig Charles, who will be presenting his Funk and Soul show live from the stage at Fully Charged Live, which is very exciting. Loads of test drives, as I said, electric bikes, buses, trucks, scooters, lots of stuff for kids, lots of science experiments.
Everything you could ever wish for,
everything,
to be honest. Everything you could ever wish for.
All in one location.
Do you know, I think we really, I mean, as we run a program which is the Midweek Drive and Midweek Drive Morning Editions, clearly we should actually sort of have the Midweek Electric Drive. We should be there. We'll need to do a location report.
We need to do that.
Robert, it's been absolutely awesome, as we knew it would be. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today?
I have. I've been most stimulated by this wonderful telephonic link, sir.
And in which case, can we prevail upon you to join us again in the near future and keep us appraised of matters ecological and transport-wise and more?
Very much so. Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
can't go wrong thinking nothing's wrong.
Earlier in the programme about electric cars, and certainly as we head through more technological reliant aspects of our life in the 21st century, online shopping is just one of those key factors which people are more and more taking for granted. It's actually caused more than two-fifths of British folk to completely forget where their car details are saved, with nearly a quarter of British folk being the victim of personal detail theft online, as we tend to shop online once a week. Let's just test it in the studio. Jenny, do you shop online?
Yes, I do.
And Emily, do you shop online?
All the time.
All the time. Yeah. So who better than to talk about some of the challenges with respect to fraudsters and so on, and ways in which this research from the Nation by Building Society kind of impacts on a whole range of things, than from the aforementioned Building Society, the wonderful Jack Bassey. How are you, Jack?
Hi there, I'm very well.
So, Jack, talk us through this particular research, which has the heading, Do You Know Who Has Your Card Details? And, of course, what's likely to come into place from September onwards?
Of course. I think it's probably important to start off with why it's important, and the main reason is protecting people's money. Online card fraud is on the rise, and it's on the rise across the whole UK. So last year, just over £500 million worth of fraud was completed. Now, banks and building societies are not sitting on their hands on this. More than £6 in every 10 of attempted fraud is blocked and stopped, and it never even hits your account. But the main focus of protecting people's data and helping them protect their data is to reduce that fraud level and reduce that criminal's ability to steal your money.
So why is it that we've become so lax when it comes to actually determining who actually has our personal data? We think, oh, what the hey, just let them know everything about me.
I think it's really, there's a number of factors here at play, and the main one is our increasing use of social media means that we more frequently just leave our personal details there out in the open. Now, that in itself isn't dangerous, but what happens is that sometimes fraudsters will trick people by pretending to be somebody else, pretending to be their bank or building society, by replaying back some of that information, and it's quite easy to lose track of it. And then when it comes to the amount of card details that people forget where they're saved. People do it because it makes life easier. It's just an easier, faster checkout mechanism. And what we need to do now is just look really, really carefully at still keeping that convenience in place, but protecting people's money more than before.
And so we come to another three-letter acronym, SCA, Strong Customer Authentication. What exactly is that going to happen, Jang? Is that going to be a yet another level? Because I'll give you a little for instance that was there. I've had a sort of notion whereby a code is passed on to the landline number that I got, and obviously that's pointless if I'm not using my mobile phone. But talk to us about strong digital ways of strong customer authentication.
Do you know what? I'm not a big fan of acronyms, and I'll describe it in a much simpler way. When we leave the front door, leave the house, you know, it's many people double lock their door. You know, you use the deadlock, you use two keys to secure something that's really important to you. And that's all it is. It's two keys to be able to identify that you really are who you say you are before any money leaves your account. Now, one of those keys is typically people always remember, like passwords, usernames and passwords, or it might be your card details themselves. The second key is going to be an SMS, a one-time passcode that will last just for a short period of time that will be sent through to your mobile phone device for you to be able to prove that it is really you. But as time goes on beyond September, we'll introduce other ways of being able to provide that second key, whether it be through an in-app notification or by using your card reader. So we recognize not everybody has a mobile phone, so we'll find options and ways for them to kind of present that second key.
Okay, let's open it up. Jenny, any thoughts or questions?
Yeah, I think it's a very good idea. I try to avoid leaving my card details anywhere. I'm a great fan of PayPal. But I think it's an excellent idea to have that second level of security.
Thumbs up from our crime writer, which is excellent. Emily, what about yourself?
I was just wondering, with iPhones and smartphones and everything now, people often have all their credit card details just saved so that you can type in a password or use even face recognition just to pay for something. Do you think that's a bad idea?
Not that it's a bad idea, but some of those services where the card details are stored on your device, that second key might be your fingerprint or your face ID. So there will be more than one way to present that second key. And the most important thing here is just kind of keeping people's money safe and secure. But the one piece of advice that I would give to, you know, all of our members and customers is, you know, make sure your bank or your building society has the most up-to-date contact details for you on file. Having those correct and on file just means that it makes it easier for us to work together to be able to protect your money.
And is that the best way to actually avoid being caught out by the changes? Because there's always that moment where you think, I didn't get the memo!
Yes, absolutely. You know, what I'd advise there is, you know, go online, use your banking app, and update those contact details. Now, there won't be any kind of cliff edge come September, and we'll make sure that, you know, service is maintained as usual, but we want to transition across to providing this extra level of security as quickly as we can.
That sounds good. I've got to say, Jag, intrigued by your title, Head of Digital Propositions. Do you actually sort of put a whole range of little proposals through, but only in a digital sense from that point of view? Because
yeah, do you know what? My kids often ask me what I do at work, and the simplest way to describe it is I work as part of a team that develop banking app and online banking. And that's the simplest way to put it.
That's wonderful. So where can people go to find out further information about what we've been chatting about this morning?
Head over to the nationwide.co.uk website, and we have some articles on there that give a bit more detail around strong customer authentication, what you need to do to be prepared. But more importantly, you know, go online, use the online banking service, or download the mobile banking app, register for it, update your details, and if you can't do either of those, then just give us a call.
Use the old telephone method, like we're doing this interview. I know, it's amazing. Human beings talking to other human beings. Wonderful. Jag Basie, Head of Digital Propositions at the Nationwide Building Society. Many thanks indeed.
Thank you.
She gets it while she can.
That iconic moment in the rooftop concert in London when the whole world was actually looking at Apple Studios. I was a child, Rob Nichols, you were a child, but do you remember that iconic moment in musical history?
I remember from watching it afterwards.
Watching it afterwards.
But, yeah, quite phenomenal because, of course, the Beatles couldn't play live, could they, really?
They could, well,
sure. So they had to play on a rooftop. That's the only way that they could actually...
They played on a rooftop. Jenny, do you remember that iconic moment in British cultural history?
Actually, I do, yes.
Yeah. Emily wasn't born, so we'll come at that in a few moments' time. But a gentleman who does remember that, and it ties in with the People's Beatles, the unseen People's Beatles, is a renowned music writer, a general all-round wonderful soul, Barry Mills. How are you? Or Barry Miles, I should say. Barry, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. And you?
Excellent. I mean, good, when you play the Beatles, what's not to love? It makes you happy, just as a matter of course, really, from that point of view.
So yes. Great. Well, I mean, we certainly need it these days.
Oh, great. Yeah, it's no surprise we're actually doing this on European Elections Day. It's very important. All you need is love, or indeed, let's not go there. Barry, the People's Beatles, and tying in with the 50th anniversary, of course, of the final performance, talk to us about this fascinating coffee table book.
Well, we launched an appeal for photographs taken by fans of the Beatles, rather than do yet another book with professional photographs. So I worked with... an agency called Photobox who helped get in the pictures. And we, exactly on the 50th anniversary, which was January 30th this year, we made a radio appeal and TV appeal for fans to send in their photographs. And so, and then finally, you know, we got in a lot of photographs, actually, really a lot. And they were wonderfully amateurish, of course, which is the whole point, is to have a different viewpoint on the Beatles. And... and now we've turned it into a book, and it's released today, as a matter of fact. And all the profits go to charity as well. The Nordoff Robbins independent music therapy charity. So it's been a very nice little project to work on. And particularly, you know, dealing with the fans rather than professional agencies and all the rest of it.
Nordoff Robbins, of course, the largest independent music therapy charity in the UK. Mm. So what was your own favourite unseen photo? I mean, I know it's radio. I mean, I think, but describing a photograph on radio, I know you can do it, Barry, because you've got the skill.
Oh, God. Well, there was this one of the Beatles crowning the May Queen in some small town somewhere. I mean, I just... love the kind of amateurish side of British sort of life back in the early 60s, you know, when before we were all so sophisticated and all had, you know, smartphones and everything. It was and everyone's looking very sort of prim and proper, and you know, big false grins on their faces. It's absolutely wonderful. There's a lot of pictures like that. Actually, most of the pictures in here are sort of action photographs, really. They're the Beatles on their way into Abbey Road, or the Beatles trying to get in their own front door and things like that. So it's usually them as individuals, which again you don't get in professional pics. Professional pics are almost always all four of them. I mean, it was only later when they had solo careers you get the solo ones. So again, it shows them as real people, that which is what they were. They were just you know, they were all in their mid-20s. They were just four blokes from Liverpool, and that's a side that you don't normally see much of. I mean, you know, most of the images are them as professionals, very very far removed from everyday life. So I like it from that point of view.
Makes sense. Okay, let's open it up. Jenny, any questions or thoughts?
How many of the pictures, and aren't most of the pictures in black and white rather than colour, considering the age?
That's a good point. A lot of them are in black and white. Yes, but. I mean, there was camcorder film just about. The problem is that, of course, photography was very expensive back then. You know, you had to take it to your chemist and you know, buy the film and everything. So people were very selective in taking a shot. Whereas now you just blast away, and you know, back then you had to make absolutely sure that you got, you know, all of his head in or his feet or something. So that was the biggest problem. But they're a mixture, definitely a mixture.
Right.
And Rob?
I've seen a lot of photographs of from 1966 of the World Cup, and I'm guessing a lot of what you're talking about is roughly the same era. And you can see, sometimes you can see that people have got like pictures of Italians walking through Sunderland, and you can see people open mouthed looking at them. It was and as you were saying, it brings across the fact that we think of like the swinging 60s, but for most people, they weren't dressed like the swinging 60s. So it's a complete, you know, that the different generations are dressed in different clothes. I always you find things like that coming across.
Oh yeah. No, it's divided up into years. I mean, we in fact started in 63, which of course is when they first became really known to the main population. But they really span the whole decade. I mean, they really are a perfect 60s band. They basically began in 60 and they broke up in 69, although they didn't announce it till 70. And they move right through from being in black and white to being in colour, full psychedelic sort of, you know, masters of the universe colour. And in the beginning, though, they're just the four mop tops, you know, the Fab Four and all of that. I mean, they change quite a lot through the era. Of course, we have more of them from about 67 when they started to do a lot more recording, and so the fans knew how to find them. You know, they knew that if they hung out at Abbey Road, that they would quite likely see them. In fact, they of course had inside contacts, and you know, they knew the receptionists and people, so they usually knew more about where the Beatles were going to be than the Beatles did. But I've been with Paul when you know, he would ask the fans where he was supposed to be going, and they knew, and he didn't. You know, so that's how it was back then. I mean, they had an incredible network of informants, and then once they got their headquarters in Savile Row, then the fans outside became known as the Apple Scruffs, and they really did know a lot. And then they were occasionally called upon to come in and add a bit of chorus, maybe, or you know, generally help out. So they'd moved up a level.
Wow.
There. I actually got to know them a bit, you know.
It certainly sort of...
George did a song called Apple Scraps later on.
It certainly looks at the whole premise of how the Simon Cowell industry sort of operates, but that's another issue for another tale, really. Emily, as somebody who was not even an iota on the horizon when the Beatles were around, what are your thoughts? Any questions for Barry?
Well, it was 50 years ago now since the last performance, so I was just wondering, like, why you think that the country still, like, loved them so much.
I wish I knew, in a way. I think it was because, well, I mean, they're the only band that people still remember all the names of from the 60s, as far as I know.
Oh, I don't know. There's Mickey Jones and Davy Jones, Mickey DeLenz, Peter Tork, and Mike Nesmith,
yes,
Monkees.
There you go. Okay.
Mick Jagger.
Yeah, the Rolling Stones might have something to say about that as well, but yes.
But there's a couple of Rolling Stones people. Well, anyway.
It's true.
Somehow they've entered British consciousness. I mean, I always like to say that they've become part of British culture in the way that the Queen and warm beer has become. You know, they've transcended just the music industry now and become a sort of symbol of Britain, particularly swinging London and the whole 60s era. And also, of course, they wrote an enormous number of brilliant songs, which continue to be covered by other artists. So that's what keeps their names really into the public eye. And it wasn't even just Lennon and McCartney. I mean, Harrison wrote some brilliant songs as well. And even, I mean, I guess Ringo's songs are...
Octopus's Garden?
Octopus's Garden.
What's Up to Love?
Sure about to record that again. Yeah.
It's an absolute classic.
No, they were multi-talented, I think. And they did break a lot of ground. And an awful lot of bands today, well, not today, but the second generation bands... after the Beatles, just had to deal with them. I mean, they were like a great roadblock, whether they liked them or not. They had to deal with the Beatles, and so they've shaped British popular music in a way that you know, you can't be denied, really. Whether you know, so everyone had to deal with them, and they're still there, and you still have to deal with them in a way.
As you said,
a band like Oasis, for instance, definitely, you know, shows a lot of Beatles influence, and Oasis then go on to influence other bands.
Yeah, we've actually got the Radio 1 Big Weekend. It's just come into town, just about a mile up the road from where we're broadcasting.
Little Mix, heavily influenced by the Beatles, I'm sure.
Well, it'll be interesting to hear if there are any Beatles songs being played. But you know that they started the ball rolling, didn't they, for British bands?
Oh yeah, definitely. And it wasn't just them. I mean, it was quite extraordinary where they led. I mean, so many other bands followed, and it was a complete transformation of the British music industry. And through them, I mean, of the whole world's music industry, because there was one time when they had almost half the top 50 in America. You know, absolutely incredible. And an awful lot of American bands, you know, from the 60s period, were influenced by seeing Hard Day's Night. You know, they saw the movie, and the next day they all went out and bought a guitar. And then and you have the birds. And,
exactly.
And all those kind of
things. Without a Hard Day's Night, no monkeys, which is the lie entirely. But let's get back to, exactly, to basics, yes. Barry. The book is available now, and profits and sales proceeds from the book will be donated to Nordoff Robbins. It's the People's Beatles. Presumably you can go to peoplesbeatles.com or photobox.co.uk.
That's it, yes.
Find out further details. Three final questions. First of all, musical choice. Would you prefer Penny Lane, Yesterday, or Ticket to Ride? Which one would you go for?
I haven't heard Ticket to Ride for a while, so let's
do
that.
Okay. I was almost going to throw in Strawberry Hill Fields Forever, but I thought, no, that'd be just
I hear that all the time.
Too much of a choice. That's Ticket to Ride is the choice. And two final questions. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the program today,
Barry? Oh, yes, very. Yes, I wasn't expecting a lot of people there, so it's always much more fun.
In which case, can we prevail upon you to join us again in the near future and keep us appraised of your life and times as indeed one of the co-founders of the UK's first counterculture newspaper, the International Times. Would you be able to return?
My goodness, yes. Yes, oh yes, well let's do that, sure.
Hooray!
She don't